Little Lord Fuckleroy
is now joining the call.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Sweet Smell of Succession, an unofficial recap podcast about the HBO original series Succession. I'm David Chen. I'm the host of podcasts like Culturally Relevant and The Filmcast. Joining me, as always, she is the host or one of the hosts of the podcast, such as Extra Hot Great, Listen to Sassy, and Again with This, Tara Ariano. How goes it today, Tara?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Really excited to dive into this very eventful episode of Succession. Season 3, Episode 4, Lion in the Meadow. Every week on this podcast, we're going to recap and spoil this week's episode of Succession. You can find more episodes of this podcast at successionpodcast.com. Email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. Before we dive into this week's episode, Tara, I wanted to mention an article that came out a couple weeks ago by Lily Loughborough over at slate.com. The title of the article, the headline of the article at slate.com is "Maybe Shiv Roy Just Sucks." 3 seasons in, what do we really know about her? And this article goes on to make the case that, quote, "At this stage in the game, it seems safe to say that Succession has a Siobhan problem. Shiv's combination of coyness, canniness, and ambition makes a lot of viewers love her. Plenty of others love to hate her. This may be because she's structurally unable to escape the strategic significance of her femaleness. It's the main way she gets singled out again and again on the show. But the issue isn't exactly that she's a woman, nor is it exactly that she's the favorite. It's that her story remains surprisingly thin. There still just isn't much to her, beyond chafing at her marriage and wanting the top job enough to do anything to get it. And it seems to me like by now, there should be. I've been waiting eagerly for Shiv's choices to be anything but dully adaptive. She's smart, after all, and eager to impress her father, whose whole philosophy requires never adapting and rejecting constraints," end quote. The article then goes on to say, like, we don't really know that much about Shiv Roy. Like, Shiv Roy has been created as a character primarily as somebody who responds to other characters,
mm-hmm.
right? And not necessarily as somebody who has her own rich inner life that we can necessarily root for. One of the things that the article identifies is, like, there's not that much vulnerability to her. You know, she kind of has this sort of very snarky like front that seems like it would be hard to get through, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the other characters like Roman and certainly Kendall, right, have a lot of vulnerability to them for a variety of reasons. Like we've seen their weaknesses and we've seen their vulnerability in detail. And I think Lily Loughborough at slate.com is kind of identifying those as elements of those characters that help us to understand them more deeply and empathize with them more. I thought there was a lot to this argument, and I am curious what you think of it in general, as I've outlined it.
I definitely think people want to like Shiv more than Shiv allows, but I don't think that's an accident in the writing or a Shiv problem, as she puts it. You know, it's sort of like when I at least was a kid, you're younger than me, but when, you know, if you were playing with a bunch of boys and they wanted to play Star Wars, you were going to be Princess Leia because that's all there was in Succession. Your female character options to like root for are Shiv or Jerry, which I think the Jerry hive is much louder than the Shiv hive, or Marsha, I guess. Like there just aren't that many female characters to like hook into. And I think mm-hmm. that's how some people consume TV, but this is like, it's a business story, so it's not going to be a women's story because that's not the world we live in. We live in patriarchy. But the question of like whether we, you know, she says at one point, do you think you know more or less about Shiv than about any of her other siblings? Like, you know, I think there's more to her than Connor, for example, who's
yes,
like more
certainly.
Of a punchline character.
Yes.
But I think the idea of like we should be rooting for Shiv is to be watching the show wrong, frankly.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think this kind of reminded me a little bit, reading this article, kind of reminded me, honestly, of like House of Cards early days with
yeah.
Kevin Spacey,
mm-hmm.
Where the whole purpose of that character is he's like subverting, you know, democratic norms to get his ways, right? And
mm-hmm.
it's fun to watch that character kind of do an end run around like the institutions and the processes we're familiar with.
Yep.
But then so spoiler for season 3 of House of Cards, but in season 3, he becomes president of the United States. So then at that point, it's like, well, what does this character even want? Like, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Because the whole time, all we've seen him be is, like, extremely underhanded and kind of a jerk and in the pursuit of power. But now that he has it, what, to what end?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel about Shiv right now, is like, and she's kind of reached, you know, the latter half of that arc is she finally has a little bit of power. To what end?
Yeah.
All we know is that she wants more power, but not much else.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's a problem. You might think that's a feature of the show, but, you know, I would like to know a little bit more about her. That's kind of,
I don't know
sense.
About a feature, but I think that's one of the things the show is about, where it's like, if you are in this environment, this is what you were bred to do. And like, you know, Kendall has, we have some vague idea of like, Kendall wants to do a media something, like it's really never clearly expressed. And the Valter story, of course, is, you know, gives the lie to that idea. But Shiv just like, I think this author's, you know, irritation is that Shiv was more interesting in season one when she was outside of the family. But it's like, that's what the story it's telling is of someone who is brought in because,
yeah,
this is what she's always wanted, despite what she may have done before.
The article also makes a really interesting point about how her wardrobe was very different in season one. Mm-hmm. Right? And
yeah.
How like, even if you accepted that she was like political operative, her wardrobe was very different. Right. Like, and
yes.
And that was likely purposeful, and that they basically have kind of changed that character. Now, you could argue it's the same character and she always wanted to kind of be in, and like the wardrobe reflects that. Or you could mm-hmm. argue they kind of took one path in season one and they decided to change it up. Right.
Yeah.
But I think that to me, it is more interesting to have a character that desperately wants to like do something good for the world and then is stymied by this institution and machine that she's part of.
Yeah,
I just don't think we have enough of the story to really know what Shiv wants right now.
Yeah, I don't think that we have any evidence that that's what she wants either.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair.
Yeah.
Other than that speech that she gave to that woman that she convinced to not testify to Congress, but she could have just, like, very likely she was doing that just to get the job done, right? In that case.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to read that scene.
agreed. So yeah. Anyway, I think there's a lot of good points here, you know, but I take your point as well about like the overall arc of the show. So
yeah.
Okay, why don't we get to this week's episode, season 3, episode 4, Lion in the Meadow. Let's start with overall thoughts. Tara, Ariana, what did you think of this episode?
I'm excited that we're starting to finally meet some of the guest stars that were you know, touted before the season started with Adrian Brody here. He's a welcome addition. It's fun when new people show up.
I love this episode. I thought, like, season 3, episodes 3 and 4 really are the show starting to get into gear.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of stuff is happening. Like, you know, Succession at its best is all about these, like, extremely tense, uncomfortable meetings, right? The most
yes.
memorable moments in the entire show. Season 1, episode 6, season 2, episode 5, season 3, episode 4 now, like, are about these like extremely tense, uncomfortable meetings that are painful for everyone involved. And this was a shining example of another entry in that genre. So I really loved it. Huge fan of season 3, episode 4. So,
yep, it was great.
All that said, what happens this episode, Tara?
Well, we get a lot of action inside the office and a really pivotal storyline outside of the office, as you alluded to. So let's start at HQ. Logan is mostly going to be out of town, and we will get to him, but he deals with a couple of matters first. He tells Shiv to be on fire watch, managing Frank and Carl as they negotiate something or other with Sandy and Stewie. I've already said this is a storyline I understand and care about the least. I'm not sure exactly what is being negotiated, but doesn't matter. What does matter is when Shiv tries to insert herself, she just ends up annoying Carl, who goes behind her back to complain about her to Logan. And then Logan calls Shiv to tell her he doesn't need another toothache, as he puts it, and to just figure out how to do her fake job better. She says if he sides with Carl, it's just going to lead to other people also jamming her out of business. But Logan doesn't care. He gave her a destination. He can't walk her to it, is what he says.
Yeah, I, you know, Tara, this is a really weird lesson to say I learned over time, but it took me a really long time to understand that, like, a surprisingly long amount of time, because I'm very slow on the uptake, to understand that, like, in a corporate environment, if someone is your boss, that doesn't necessarily mean they can tell you what to do and you will do it.
Right.
You know? I know that's like, people listening are probably like, oh, of course, it's obvious. Everyone has like autonomous power. But like, I guess when I was growing up, I was like, oh, yes, the boss tells people what to do. Like, that's how I always conceived of it. Mm-hmm. What you realize when you get older is that's not the case of how it works most of the time. The boss has very little power. And actually, like, a lot of a manager's power is their ability to A, inspire confidence, and B, influence people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have those skills, then you will likely be successful. But here, this is a dynamic that occurs so often in the corporate environment where, like, you have somebody who's, like, relatively untested, and they need a vote of confidence from the person before. They need, like, some kind of, you know, some sign that the person who's come before is, like, endorsing their viewpoint and, like, stands with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's very characteristic for Logan to not give that. But
right.
I just, my heart went out to Shiv in that moment, because it's a very common thing to need that and then not get it.
Because it's not, it wasn't clear to me what he was even asking her to do. He was just like, go handle it. And she was like, okay. And she tried to, and then he was like, no, not like that. Like, she's really in a no-win situation here.
Totally, totally, yeah. I mean, I think that she goes and she, like, she kind of gives them what for, and then they very clearly patronize her, and it's like they're not going to take orders from this person because they've been around this company for decades, you know? Like, yeah. This person just showed up. Why would they listen to her? So,
right.
It's a very challenging situation to be in. I felt like one kind of weird thing about this episode is, like, the timeline is just really weird. Like,
mm-hmm.
It feels like it compresses, like, a week's worth of events into, like, 6 hours, basically.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit weird that they're having all these interactions. Like, yeah, Carl said this, and then she, you know, then she does this thing with Ravenhead and everything like that. And then the Ravenhead result occur, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
It just felt like it should take longer. But anyway.
Guess if your show is on at 3:30, then someone can come in at 2 and tell you, hey, say this. And then you
it's
do,
true.
And the president hears it at 3:35 and gets on the
it's
phone.
It's true. I guess I just feel like a Ravenhead show would have more preparation than, let's say, this podcast. You know what I
mean? Do you get that impression when you see clips of Tucker Carlson? Because I don't.
All right. Fair enough. What else happens this episode, Tara?
So the other job Logan gives Shiv to do is getting, as we said, Mark Ravenhead to be meaner to the president on the air. And she initially tries to make Tom do it, which he doesn't want to, both because he knows Ravenhead won't listen to him and because there should be more of a separation, in his opinion, between Shiv's department and his. But surprise, Shiv does not care as much about the org chart as Tom does and basically orders him to do it. And Tom, as expected, washes out. But Shiv, having been yelled at by Logan, goes to Ravenhead directly to tell him the direction is coming straight from Logan. And Ravenhead doesn't seem particularly intimidated by her, but he does it. And Logan hears from the president immediately that the president is pissed. And Logan might have more time to oversee Ravenhead's show if he wasn't so busy with the investigation. Hint, hint, he says to the president. So good job being shitty. She did one thing right today.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this whole Tom thing was felt like a repeat of Bora on the Floor in season 2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like where she goes and she's like, tell dad to kill the deal, you know, and then he tries to do it and then ends up on the floor begging for his life. And then he gets home and he's really sad about it. And it felt like in a more extreme version of that, because Tom is clearly not mentally well right now, you know?
Oh, yes. And we will get to him.
Yeah.
It's also funny that when Logan talks to Shiv at the top of the episode, he says a problem with Carl is that he's smart, but he likes to be liked, which makes him less effective. And I appreciate that we get confirmation in this episode that that is not a concern for Shiv.
She does not care about being liked. They don't get embarrassed, apparently.
Yeah, so. That was a great line.
Amazing.
So Ravenhead isn't Shiv and Tom's only concern. There's also Greg, and Logan calls him over to the apartment to try to get him to sign on to a joint defense agreement. Greg recognizes that he has valuable information that he is so far still holding back, but initially, one-on-one with Logan, he's not sure how to open negotiations. Logan asks what he wants, Greg asks what he can get, and Logan is like, no, that's not how this works. Meanwhile, Tom is in a bad way. He has gotten the nickname Terminal Tom because he has cancer of the career and is browsing possible prison camps he expects he may soon be sentenced to live in. And after he goes on Shiv's orders to try to shore up Greg's support for Logan, Tom's spirits don't really improve. Let's hear clip 2.
All due respect to ATN and you, but I feel that where my heart is Parks.
Right.
Really. I think experience economy is maybe where it's at.
Let's game this out. Come on, let's game
okay.
it out.
So I was thinking of asking for operations director, then kill Ray.
Yes, Ray's an asshole. And then maybe, I think, you know, start hands-on.
No, exactly, get in at a tier 2 park, ask for deputy at, like, Bright Star Buffalo, so I'm home on weekends. Easy peasy.
Right! Perfect. So I guess you've already gamed it.
You know? But thank you.
So, Tom truly has nothing left to teach Greg. In fact, maybe Greg has just taught Tom that Tom should have asked for something when he offered himself up to Logan to take the fall for cruises in the last episode.
This is like, remember in Office, The Office season 2 with Michael Scott, like when they actually showed that he was a competent salesperson?
Yes.
You know, like you've seen him be incompetent for like many episodes, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, he's actually good at his job, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting because we know Greg mostly as a bumbling idiot, but then he provides this fairly coherent, you know, articulation of how he wants to make his next career moves. And it's like, oh, he actually does have some skills at this point.
And a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. But what are your thoughts on Greg's role in this episode, Tara?
Well, I hope this also convinces anyone who still thought Greg was the norm of the satire and the one good guy just blundering along through all of these events that, no, he's just as venal as everyone else in the Roy family. Like, remember, this saves the day, the other goes away. So much was saving the day. Like, he's just going to get his.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it really hit home to me at the end of season one when he blackmails, or he doesn't blackmail Kendall, but he kind of indicates that he might want to blackmail Kendall. And then in season two, he 100% blackmails Tom, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think that now he has made the move from like, I'm dipping my toe into the blackmail waters to now I'm just going to, you know, cut some throats to get what I want.
Yep.
So.
Well, their conversation goes on from there. Let's hear clip 3.
an amusing notion has just occurred to me, Greg.
Yeah?
Yes. You're going to be running a theme park. And here's me going to jail. And you're going to be living in a magical castle. And I am going to be down in a dungeon somewhere sucking off ogres for phone cards.
No, I mean, who even knows? This probably won't work.
Greg, what do you know about Nero and Sporus?
Nero and
Sporus. Greg, yeah. Sporus was a young slave boy. He was Nero's favorite. And you know what Nero did to him?
Nero and Sporus, this is not IP I'm familiar with.
Well, Nero pushed his wife down the stairs. And then he had Sporus castrated, and he married him instead. And he gave him a ring, and he made him dress up like his dead wife.
Wow. Plot twist. Didn't see that coming.
Yeah, I bought a book on the Romans to read in prison. It's a big book.
Well, is it a good book?
It's a decent book, yeah. I'd castrate you and marry you in a heartbeat.
So on my other podcast, Extra Hot Great, we have a Patreon where we do bonus episodes. And we very recently talked about the episode of Ancient Rome, The Rise and Fall of an Empire, in which Michael Sheen plays Nero. And what he does to Sporus is portrayed not graphically. It is very visceral. It is a wild 53 minutes of a show. It's on YouTube. Michael Sheen leaves no piece of scenery unchewed. He is like going for it 150%. It's incredible.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about this IP either. Amazing line. And, you know, I had read some kind of behind the scenes stories about the show before this season began, and they're kind of talking about how, like, the real, you know, Tom is married to Shiv, but the real love story in the show is between Tom and Greg.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I feel about that, but I certainly felt it in that moment when he said that. And I was like, wow, that's very, what an uncomfortable thing to say for everyone in that situation, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think literally that's what he wants. I don't think it's like a romantic love story, but there's something there.
Yeah.
I can see it.
Just it's like a bromance, I guess, of sorts. Maybe Tom, like, it really, I don't know. He's grown very attached to Greg is very clear, I think.
Yeah,
well, what's putting interesting aside any romantic thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What's interesting about it is that it's always shifting. Like, sometimes Tom feels paternal towards him, and sometimes he's like a bullying older brother, and sometimes he's seeking Greg's approval, or he wants Greg to be proud of him. Like, it's interesting.
I think it can be very challenging for a person like Tom, who basically is an outsider in this world, mm-hmm. right, to then see another outsider and enter and then potentially surpass him. Mm-hmm. I think that it basically stirs up like lots of conflicting emotions. Like you want to be paternal. You also want to be, you also like want them to have the same challenges that you went through. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're seeing a lot of that mixed in with the threat of prison time for Tom is what's happening here. So,
yeah. Well, the difference too between Tom and Greg is that, and we've talked about this before, it's established that Tom's parents back in Minneapolis are both lawyers. So he came from, you know, a fairly comfortable background, he mm-hmm. thought, until he met Shiv and then was like, exposed to this whole world of wealth that he probably could not even conceive of until he was in it. And so I think part of him probably saw the same sort of thing in Greg because he is sort of an outsider, but Greg is also sort of not an outsider, right? He also has a cushion of yeah. wealth, you know, to fall back on in case of emergency. I mean, Ewan is very withholding, but it seems like when trouble has happened, Greg has been okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's also different.
So what else happens with Tom this episode? We got to talk about like what's going on with Tom.
Well, so then Tom, at the end of this conversation, tries to get Greg to physically fight him in yet another pitiful moment in a long list of them for these two. Like, Tom, fighting Greg will not prepare you for prison. Like, not even white-collar prison. It's not going to help you.
It's such a an uncomfortable scene because, like, Tom is kind of doing, like, abusive gaslighting behavior. You know, he's like,
yeah.
I'm just joking. You know, I'm just mm-hmm. joking. Like, it's really painful. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And we get more later about Tom's worries about possibly having to serve time. And while they're framed in a very funny way, like he has realized there is no fine wine in prison. There's only whatever he can teach himself to make from fruit and ketchup. Shiv's inability to hear what he's saying, what he's trying to tell her, is so dark. Like, she keeps just being like, hey, are you OK? Like, he's not. He's definitely not OK. And yes, it is about the prison possibility, as she kind of whispers to him, like, yeah, I think it's probably that.
Indeed, indeed. So there is a Roman side plot in this episode, right?
There is. It's not much of a plot, but yes, there. Roman has remembered some oppo he thinks could be useful against Kendall, who he calls Wocahontas. In the course of an ironic bar crawl he and Kendall did in New Orleans some time ago, they came across a person Roman rudely refers to as a hobo. And after discussing a variety of ways they might assault this person's dignity for money he really needed, like getting him to eat a deck shoe, for instance, what ultimately happened is that they tattooed Kendall's initials on his forehead, and Roman has located Tattoo Man and brings him with his lawyer into the office. And this guy's gotten his life together enough to have had the tattoo removed, although it is still very faintly visible. And Roman would still like evidence of what had happened, though, and pays this guy $1 million for any photos he may have. And he's very excited to use them against Kendall, so Jerry has to explain how being a party to this abusive tattoo man doesn't really reflect well on Roman either. Which, like, this seems like a much worse mark on Kendall's record as a human being than anything we've specifically heard to this point, other than the manslaughter, obviously. So I'm curious to see how this comes up again as this season or series goes on.
It does feel like a lot of time to spend on a subplot that's not going to come back. You know,
mm-hmm.
And obviously it illustrates something that we already knew about Roman, which is he's willing to, you know, use money as leverage to amuse himself, to gain advantage for himself right from the very first episode with the baseball and the $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So another instance of that kind of again. So,
yep. We also learn that Jerry went for lunch with an ex-DOJ contact, this guy named Lori, whom Roman decides without evidence is elderly, but of whom he is still jealous. I wanted this to turn out to be the guy that Alexander Skarsgård is playing, but I looked it up and it's not.
Yeah, I'm curious. We never see that person, so I'm curious like where that's going and if there's going to be some love triangle action going on here, Tara. But we'll see.
Perhaps. And Connor tries to talk his way into a real job at Waystar just for now so he can counter accusations that his presidential campaign is bullshit because he's never even held a real job. And Shiv offers him a wine tasting show on Waystar's awesomely named food network Gourmando, but Connor will not be bought off so cheaply and threatens to come out against Logan if he isn't pacified, but he doesn't. So I guess stick a pin in that. We'll see what happens there.
Yeah,
if anything.
Just plus one on Gourmando being an awesome name. Like, you instantly kind of know what that is, even though
it's very good.
We've never seen it. Yeah, it's very good. So, yeah.
But The main event revolves around a huge investor named Josh Aronson. This is the guy who's played by Adrian Brody, who we mentioned already. And shocking no one, Josh was alarmed by news of the raid and is considering siding with Sandy and Stewie at the shareholders meeting. So he uses his clout to demand a sit down with Roman and Logan together. And Kendall refuses at first, but Frank, on Logan's orders, as we see, but Kendall does not, talks him into it by raising the specter of losing Josh's backing to Stewie and Sandy. And Josh then throws a wrench in the works by claiming his daughter's too ill for him to come to Manhattan and changes the location for the meeting from a lawyer's office in New York to Josh's country house on his private island, I guess, in the Hamptons. But I feel like they could have just taken helicopters from New York to Long Island. So it might be Martha's Vineyard. Unclear. Mm-hmm. The point is, this guy is real rich, possibly richer than Logan, whose country house is not on a private island, as we saw in season two.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, I think they did a good job of selling this guy as rich. It's a fairly, like, understated rich, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? Like, what I mean by that is it felt like the house somebody who has, like, $10 million could own just from looking at the architecture, not necessarily the fact that it's private island. But I thought, as with all the richness on the show, much of it is quite tasteful, I thought. I don't know what what did you feel about his house and the environs there?
It's all right. Just kidding. It was beautiful. Yeah. I thought it looked dumb. No, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a very nice house. But let's talk about the grotesque waste of these two messy bitches, Kendall and Logan, each taking their own helicopter and their own private plane to the island. Because Jesus Christ.
That's like probably like 5,000 plastic straws right there worth of carbon footprint, you know? Even just
that
to
is
film
how
it.
We measure carbon footprints now in plastic.
Even
so
just
yes,
to film it,
accurate.
So you could eat, you could use, you know, paper straws the rest of your life, and it would not equal, you know, the amount of carbon that these put in the atmosphere from that trip. So
it's pretty bad. So before driving from the airstrip to Josh's compound, Kendall and Logan are supposed to have a brief strategy meeting on the tarmac so that their messaging is aligned before they meet Josh, but Logan makes Kendall take the first plane out so that Logan doesn't have to wait for him to land on the island, and Kendall gets Logan back by leaving in the car before Logan lands.
Yeah, hey, so look, I think it's pretty obvious what we need to say, so I'm headed straight to Josh's compound. Tell Dad, meet me.
It's from Roadrunner.
Everyone knows the best jokes are the ones you have to explain. Guess the Lampoon kids aren't writing Kendall's material anymore.
Yeah, meep, it's from Roadrunner. Why does he think that Logan would know what Roadrunner is but not know what meep is? That's my question. But anyway.
Right. Or that his assistant wouldn't know what it is when she's like in her 30s, maybe. So Kendall gets to the house first. And when we actually meet Josh, he seems like the kind of effortlessly cool guy Kendall is always desperately trying to be. This motherfucker is wearing four layers inside. He's in a t-shirt, button down, cardigan, and hoodie. And then when they go on a walk later, he puts a vest over it. Meanwhile, like, he looks like he's just stepped off the cover of GQ, all rumpled and cool. And Kendall is, under his black incognito baseball cap, shoulder to toe in brown, the color of cowards, TM, Kids in the Hall, sketch I never forgot.
I thought the black caps were a nice touch. It looked kind of like, kind of classy, you know? Mm-hmm. Both Logan and Kendall wearing the black caps. But yeah, I agree with you that this is the guy that, like, Kendall wishes he was. Because mm-hmm. he clearly does not seem to give a fuck what anyone thinks, you know?
Yeah,
that's kind of my sense.
Mm-hmm. So Kendall tries to make the most of the time he has alone with Josh by talking at him, but unlike Kendall's usual audiences, Josh is rich enough not to have to pretend to be impressed.
But yeah, look, it's a fuck pie, but end of the day, it's not that complicated. Like, I'm better than my dad, but my dad is still better than Sandy and Stewie.
Yeah, my other option is you know, just get out.
Well, the comet is coming. Mm-hmm. I think a single acquisition. We buy in an oven-ready UI, machine learning, social media, super app dinges. We buy Gojo.
It's a little overpriced.
I don't know. Great UI, shitty content. Meet shitty UI, great content. Mm-hmm. You know, I like you. Outside of all this, I really like you.
I like you too, pal.
Big fucking nervous breakdown of a party for my 40th. You gotta come.
Yeah, who's going?
What, you need the list? You, me, and Henry Kissinger. Fuck you, I know everybody. It's gonna be the bomb.
Oh, cool, yeah.
We should hang more.
Yeah.
Who's Going is such a great cold diss, and it tells you so much about these two and their relationship. Despite Kendall trying to manufacture this closeness between them, Josh does not feel that way.
It's painful because of the desperation. You know, Kendall's just always kind of leaking desperation at all times. Mm-hmm. So
So then Logan arrives and he asks after Josh's daughter, and then, having gotten the report and Josh's pro forma apology for moving the meeting to the compound, says, "I know what it's like," as though Logan has ever stayed home with a sick child. I thought that was very funny. Because Josh knows that too.
Agreed.
So the moment that Josh just stands there waiting for Kendall and Logan to perform familiar closeness for him really makes you realize how much calculation underlies this day beyond just pretending his daughter's sick to get them out there.
I thought that this, one of the longest succession shots in all of succession history was that shot of just them standing there in silence and you sitting, thinking their thoughts. You have no idea what's going on, but it's clearly extremely awkward.
Yes.
And I was like, wow, it's not like it for Succession to just hold a shot like this for this long on nothing happening.
But everything's happening.
Yeah. Agreed. So. Yeah. I also like the subtle reversal where you expect Josh to be on Kendall's side because of their kind of dialogue before. You're like, oh, Kendall's plan is working. You know, he's winning Josh over to his side. But then immediately after, you discover that's not the case. So,
yeah, I didn't think that that Kendall was convincing him.
Yeah.
He just sort of, he says, we're going to buy this other company, Gojo. And he's like, maybe. I mean, I think he was just trying to get through the moment. I think he's still... thinks Logan is the man, and everything else that happens sort of shows us that until he decides no one is the man, maybe. But Logan tries to win Josh over in his usual way, seeming to be in control, offering virtually no specifics. This does not work either, but Josh does want to keep talking and suggests that they go for a walk. Logan obviously doesn't want to. He says, how far? Which, I feel you, brother. But the fact that he agrees also tells us just how important Josh is to the company's future.
Josh, I thought just in terms of walk politics, the politics of taking a walk, I don't know. I thought Josh was a little bit insensitive, because Logan
he's
is an old man.
He's in his 80s.
Yeah, he's an old man. If he doesn't want to walk, that's completely understandable. But anyway.
I think it was a test. I don't think that was insensitive. I think it was calculated.
Perhaps. Anyway.
So Josh, when they're out, puts numbers to his interests. We've already heard he holds a 4% stake, and recent scandals have caused him to lose 10% of his 4%, $350 million. Yikes. He does not seem to care at all about institutional rot at Waystar, other than to ask at one point exactly what Kendall has on Logan, because if it's nothing, Kendall looks like a phony, but if it's serious, Josh may not want to keep a stake at all. And says in so many words that the easiest way for them, the Roys, to get Josh to continue backing them would be if Kendall took back what he said, causing Kendall to accuse Logan and Josh of cooking up this whole meeting as an ambush. But ultimately, what Josh wants is for them to persuade him that Logan and Kendall will be able to work together again in a functional situation. Clip 6.
So, can you work together?
Uh-huh.
Sure. Absolutely.
This is tough. It's fucking tough, I gotta say, because I don't really believe you. I mean, I kind of don't.
It'll be okay, because he's a good kid.
He's a good kid?
Yeah, he's a good kid.
Okay.
Yeah, he did what he thought was best. I think he went too far, but he's a good kid.
Yeah?
He's a good kid, and I love him. I mean, there'll be a big number, we'll pay, he'll mew and cry, and I'll get it, it'll all be okay. And maybe it'll be him one day. It's in his blood. He learned it all from me. Maybe he's the best one of all of them. So, yeah, it'll be okay.
Wow. Well, so that's nice to hear, right?
You can barely hear it in the clip, but after he says, are you going to be able to work together? They're both like, there's a long pause and they're like, yeah. And he clearly does not believe them because they are not convincing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Josh is all of us.
Did you you ever see that movie, The 25th Hour?
Mm-mm.
Great movie. Spike Lee joint. And there is a incredible, I think you can find this scene on the internet because it's so amazing. But there's a scene at the end of the movie, spoilers for 25th Hour, where basically Brian Cox sort of starts narrating the protagonist's life, like an imagined version of the protagonist's life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think probably the most memorable line from it is like, you'll tell them like how close this life came to never happening. It's like very wistful, beautiful scene. And it reminded me a lot of his performance here, where he's like, it'll be okay. You know, like he's telling this very kind of wistful, hopeful story, but it's full of lies in this case. You know, in that case, he was like, it was very earnest. And in this case, it's he's just lying. And I thought that was like, it's very powerful because it's basically all the things that Kendall wants to hear, but it's lies, which is very, very sad. So,
or he believes it. It's hard to tell. Like he might still think they could get past this. You know?
Yeah. I guess my sense is that his statements in this scene are completely undermined in the following scene when they kind of curse each other out.
Well, that's true. And we also know that Logan will say whatever he needs to
exactly.
whoever he's talking to, you know, win or come out ahead or whatever.
A few other thoughts on this scene, Tara. First of all, why is no one eating this delicious seaside lunch that has been meticulously prepared for them?
Yeah. I mean, I hate a picnic, so I get it. Personally,
I mean, the lunch looks freaking delicious and delightful. Okay,
it
so
does.
It's a crime to let it go to waste.
It does.
Almost on par with taking two private jets.
True.
They should not have let this food go to waste. The other thing is, I don't know about you, Tara, but over the course of the last couple of years, I've had a lot of outdoor meetings with people, like friends and stuff.
Yeah.
We have actually, my wife and I have actually outfitted our garage to, she calls it the COVID living room. Basically, we have a little heater, we have a table there. And so whenever we have guests over, we have them in the garage and we have heaters set up and it looks a little nice. And that way we can all kind of be outside while still spending time together.
Yeah.
And I kind of got some COVID era vibes from this scene. I was like, maybe they like, were like, hey, we got to shoot a scene with Adrian Brody. And Adrian Brody's like, I'm only doing this outside.
You know? Right.
Or I'll be inside for one scene, but then we're doing everything else outside, which would have been, I don't know if I have no idea if that's true. Maybe it's not even Adrian Brody. Maybe it's just like they thought it'd be safer for, like the filmmakers thought it'd be safer for everyone to do it that way. But it did remind me, you know, putting aside the amazing beachside view and the very custom lunch, it did remind me of a lot of my meetings with friends during the COVID era.
A couple of things about that. One is, as I said, I think the walk is calculated, and I think that was part of the story. Whether they had to backfit it so it would, you know, make sense for whatever restrictions, who knows? But in terms of the lunch, I can tell you, rich people love to be served fancy food outside, and here's how I know. Last year, right before lockdown, my parents were very generous, and they took me and my sister, her family, my husband, all of us went to Kenya for a safari. And what would happen every day when we were, you know, at the what was called the camp, it was not a camp, it was a, you know, beautiful resort. You would go on a game drive in the morning, and then you would go drive through the park and try and see animals, basically. And always we would, of course. And then we would have like what they called bush breakfast, and you would stop after like an hour and a half or something. And they would have driven ahead from the resort and set up like a beautiful, like fancy restaurant brunch with all tiffins, like, and cooked everything out there, like, you know, on a hot plate or whatever. And that's what this reminded me of. It's like, oh, that takes me back to a trip I will probably never get to have again. But it was sure nice while it lasted.
Yeah, it's nice to have it's like a picnic. It's like glamping, you know, it's like a picnic, but without the bad parts of it, pretty much.
Yeah.
So
And like, it wasn't just some guy setting up. It was like a chef in a chef's jacket. Like, it was the guy who made it. It's crazy.
Nice. Nice.
Anyway, the Roys seem to have put on a convincing enough performance for Josh. But on the walk back, we see that's all it was. Kendall tries to get Logan to retire, denigrates him for his advanced age, shits on Shiv for her incompetence in her new job, and criticizes Logan for the barely veiled anti-Semitic remarks Josh surely has noticed all day. And Logan tells Kendall he's just flipped Greg. Roman's got Tattoo Man in his back pocket and Kendall has lost. But then Logan's physical exhaustion becomes impossible for either of them to ignore. They both try to cover so that Josh doesn't think Logan is anything less than the bear Kendall insists he is. But Logan soon loses his strength. Kendall blames Logan's collapse on too much sun. But the damage is done. As Roman yells at Kendall over the phone, Josh is using Logan's temporary physical incapacitation to support his lack of faith in Waystar's leadership and is going with Sandy and Stewie after all. And this sure feels inevitable. I would say only at his very lowest depths in season two could Kendall have convinced anyone that he loves his father and wants nothing more than to work with him forever. But the staging for the breakdown was masterfully done by Josh, I think. He isn't just some dipshit who got lucky at the casino one night. He is good at being rich.
I think what you're proposing, which I think is very plausible and likely even, is that Josh kind of orchestrated this whole thing to A, test out Logan's physical capacity, and B, kind of test their relationship as well, right?
Yeah. Under duress, like, to see how they would act under pressure and stress, not just like comfortably sitting in his nice living room.
Right. Well, let me just say, Taro, as I was watching this, I was like, you know what? This whole Logan breakdown is only happening because of toxic masculinity.
You know? Yeah.
Because he can't just be like, I need to have a seat for a few minutes. You know, like, he's got to press on and
I'm
like
80.
Yeah, right. He's got to kind of put this show of like, I'm strong and nothing can stop me. And that is a shame.
Yeah.
A couple of other observations. I love like how, you know, they kind of put on this image. They're trying to desperately convince this guy like, hey, we're a happy loving family, but then they like say like the most biting mean-spirited things to each other like right after they're out of earshot. It captures the tension at the heart of many families, which is there is a difference in how people present themselves and how they are in reality, and those things can often be in like juxtaposed next to each other in time at a rather like close points, you know, like you would feel like, oh, maybe they're in a good mood now, but nope, right at like minutes later, it's like we're back at each other's heels. And finally, they're really leaning hard into the racism and homophobia of Logan this season, I think. He used a very derogatory slur for Hispanic people, I believe, in the scene.
He did.
And he used the derogatory slur for gay people last episode. And it reminds me of something that was said on Extra Hot Great approximately 8 years ago, which is, something you said, I think it was you that said it, Tara, but you were talking about how The Sopranos, like every once in a while, they would have like Tony Soprano, like, brutally murder someone or something like that, just like kind of remind you that this guy that you're rooting for is actually like a terrible human being.
Right.
It kind of reminded me a little bit of like Logan Roy is such a kind of like likable, cantankerous figure, in my opinion, that they need to, they want to remind you, actually, no, he's actually extremely toxic. And I know maybe like people will see that in other ways in seasons one and two, but I feel like adding in the homophobia and the racism really kind of, there was very little of that in seasons one and two. And I feel like they're bringing it more to the fore in this season to kind of make clear that he, like, how toxic he is. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think in his case, it may just be that he's like, he can't be bothered to keep the mask on as much as he could maybe in another era, because at least in this plotline, he's not the only one who's being anti-Semitic about Josh. Like someone else, I think Roman calls him a chiseler. Carl says he wants his pound of flesh. Like these are barely, as I said, barely veiled anti-Semitic remarks about him, but they're not saying them when Josh is in his presence. Logan's the only one who's like, well, you're a long way from your coffee and bagel, which could be a remark about him being a New York boy or something else. It's, you know, that one's still on the line, perhaps. But
yes.
It's also clear, like, Josh is not fazed by it. Like, this is nothing he hasn't heard before, or that he wouldn't expect to hear from Logan. Like, that's not to excuse it, but I agree. Yeah. I think it's more, this is also the question that I always have, like, since the first season, which is like, how much of Logan is just a hateful man and how much of it is like, he is neurologically impaired, and some of this is like sundowning or dementia, where he's just like not able to keep up a facade anymore.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting interpretation. In any case, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this recap. I thought this is like a great, like so many things happen. Like you have Shiv dealing with Connor and Ravenhead, and you got Kendall and Logan trying to make this deal happen, and clearly it didn't go great. And it culminates with like the ultimate failure of this. But I appreciated what this episode is trying to do, which is that there is so much madness going on at this company, right? Mm-hmm. That like there have to be kind of investor consequences for that. Like any other company that was riven by this series of scandals, there would be some kind of reckoning. And it was very interesting in this episode to have a dynamic where there's somebody who actually has power over these people.
Yeah.
It's very rare that's the case. We mostly see them dealing with their lackeys for like 90% of the time.
Yes.
And so to have them dealing with somebody who actually could do something negative to them, I thought was really interesting and not something we've seen before. So I really love this episode.
The fact that he's like a young, cool guy and not just another old bastard. Like, I mean, he's kind of bastardy in his way, but you know, it's not the same kind of vibe that we've seen in other similar situations.
Yeah. Well, that's the end of the recap, but we still got winners and losers coming up and our quote of the week. Before we get to that, though, you know, Tara, if people are listening to this and they're like, I want more of Tara's winning insights on the world of television, where can they find those things?
Well, what they're probably going to be most interested in, if they're not sick of hearing me talk about Succession, here is my recaps of Succession at Decider.com, which are going up after the episode every Sunday night. So
I just need to point out that this is a distinctly different recap than the one that you give on this podcast, right?
Like, yes. They
it
are
is not,
the same.
Just like you're cutting and pasting it into the show notes. Like
I do not plagiarize myself.
You basically do two distinct recaps in different styles, and one of them is for Decider. And it is, again, I strongly urge people to check out Tara's work and her recaps of Succession. Don't worry, it is the same episode that is covered, but it is a different recap. So
thank you so much, that's lovely of you to say. But you can also find links to everything else that I do on my Twitter, which is Tara Ariano, TaraAriano.
I'm at Dave Chensky, Dave Chen SKY on Twitter, and check out my other podcast, Culturally Relevant, where I interview writers, directors, actors, and so on. Recently had guests like Noomi Rapace and Edgar Wright on the show. Great time talking with those folks. Again, Culturally Relevant is the name of the podcast. Let's get to winners and losers of the week. Every week, we choose a winning person from the Roy family and a losing person from the Roy family, as well as somebody who won from outside the Roy family and who lost from outside the Roy family. Won what, you might ask? Literally anything that we decide. There are no rules, and the points are all made up, and so on and so forth. So, okay. So winning Roy this week, who do you think, Tara?
He's only technically a Roy, but I'm going with Greg, who, as we already discussed, he's plotted his own future and fixed his terrible situation. As far as we know, everything's coming up, Greg.
I agree with you completely. I would say Shiv is kind of a distant second because she actually was able to do what her dad wanted. And
she did execute in the end. Yes.
Yeah. So that was fun to see. Okay. Losing Roy.
Kendall.
As usual.
Yeah.
He's been like the losing Roy for like multiple episodes this season already. He's having a rough season so far, Tara.
I think he won last week because of the raid, right? But then
I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah. But it was short-lived.
Oh no, we said Roman. We said Roman and Tom. Oh, it wasn't there Kendall.
Kendall because did not he was watching the raid from a
that's right,
from a server room, so.
From a hiding place. Right. Yeah. Kendall Kendall fucked it up this week real bad.
Winning non-Roy, in your opinion?
Well, with an honorable mention to Tattoo Man, because he did get $1 million, I'm gonna say Stewie, because he has Josh on side now, and honestly it feels like a much better temperament match, the two of them. I hope you get to see scenes of Josh and Stewie interacting. We briefly see them hug on the tarmac, but I want more.
Those guys would get along way better than Kendall and Josh.
For sure.
And I agree with you about that winning non-Roy. I think it's Stewie. Like, you know, he's getting Josh's support. But I would also say Josh is also winning non-Roy this week because he's no longer betting on the catastrophic team that is Logan and Kendall. So
yep.
Losing non-Roy.
Well, we didn't talk about it before, but it is established in this episode that Kendall has bought his children a rabbit.
I was like, what is Tara talking about in the show notes? You wrote the rabbit. I'm like, what is happening here? Yes, there is a rabbit in this episode. I just remembered it now that you said it. Yeah.
He's bought a rabbit for his children. He's keeping it in like a pen on the floor in the living room at his house, not even at Rava's house where they normally mostly live. And at one point, he gets a call, but then the kids get a call. They have an iPad set up next to the rabbit pen to be rabbit cam. And Jess, his assistant, is charged to like get on FaceTime and hold the iPad up to the rabbit for the kids.
Yes. And why is that rabbit losing non-Roy, Tara?
Because if Kendall forgets that rabbit exists, that rabbit is fucked. That rabbit's life depends completely on Jess and her ability to get in and out of Kendall's place.
I don't see
Kendall as a loving pet parent.
I've been thinking about rabbits recently, Tara, because we have a lot of rabbits like around our house. Like when we go on walks, there's like a lot of little cute little rabbits.
Cute.
I always wonder, like, for rabbits, do you think it's worth it to be in a cage for most of the time and get fed? You know, or is it like? Would never need to worry about your bodily needs? Or would rabbits rather run free and then potentially be subject to predation and not finding enough food?
Yeah, rabbits are like, they're very active. It's not like a dog where they just want to hang around you mostly, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, if only we could know the minds of rabbits is what I'm trying
Good
to
luck
say.
To that rabbit.
Indeed. Okay, I actually chose for my losing non-Roy, someone you chose as the winning non-Roy, which was the tattoo guy. Yes, he got $1 million, but in the end, he lost his dignity with the huge possibility that the photo is going to be come back in a later episode, I think.
I feel like if I'm Tattoo Man, I have my lawyer who has traveled with me stipulate that any photos only show me from like the eyes up.
Yeah, I don't think they did that in this case, but yes, I would agree with you. Also, if I'm Tattoo Man, I would have asked for, 5 to 10x what he got in this case. I'd be like, yeah, I'm willing to take money in exchange for my dignity, but like, I don't want to have to work again. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
So I don't think he asked for enough.
He didn't ask for anything. That was just the number that was thrown. And frankly, they cut away after Roman says it, so we don't know anything about those negotiations. Maybe he did bid it up.
We'll see.
We will.
Quote of the week, Tara?
Well, we already heard it at the end of one of the clips that we played, but it's Tom telling Greg very warmly, I'd castrate you and marry you in a heartbeat.
Indeed. What a heartwarming thing to say.
A beautiful sentiment.
My favorite quote is, it's a fuck pie, but at the end of the day, it's not that complicated. That's Kendall. Mm-hmm. And I guess, I don't know, that one of the great things about Jesse Armstrong's work is you are hearing words combined together in ways that you have never heard before, and
yeah.
I don't know if I've ever heard the term fuck pie before in my life.
I think it's in a previous episode because it's quoted in that Lily Loughborough piece. This might be a Roy family phrase because they quote Shiv saying it.
Well, regardless, it's very vivid.
Yeah.
Know?
Yep.
I don't know what a fuck pie is.
You never saw American Pie?
When I try to picture it, it's gross, you know? So, all right. Anyway. That's going to bring us into this week's episode. Tara, thank you, as usual, for chatting with me today. I really
appreciate
it. Thank
you.
And thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of this podcast at successionpodcast.com. Email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next week for our recap of season 3, episode 5.